Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to Two Ends Meet, a special edition of All Things Policy. In these episodes, we bring together Takshashila's founders, Narayan and Nitin, to talk about some of the key issues of the day. I'm Aditya, and if this episode sounds a little different to you, it's of course because we're not in our regular studio. We're recording in our respective homes amid the ongoing global pandemic. And it's actually the pandemic that's the topic of our episode today. A few days back, Nitin had written a very interesting piece in Mint, arguing that what we're seeing now, this current global pandemic may actually be the last. And Nitin has argued that a combination of a few factors, technology, namely computer technology and synthetic biology, talent, people getting into this field, and government investment are basically going to mean that viruses really don't stand much of a chance. So welcome, Nitin and Narayan.
Thanks, Aditya. Good to be on the show.
Great. Nitin, I want to start with you. Tell us, what is this case that you're making?
You know, I've gone out on a limb on this one. And I mean, I've told this to many of our students and to our staff that an analyst should not be in the business of making predictions. We should be painting scenarios and recommending how do we prepare for any eventuality that sort of turns up. But I violated my own injunction and said, let's make a prediction here. The prediction is very simple, that we've had pandemics ever since we've had recorded history and probably even pre-recorded history also. But my argument is that within the next 15 years, I think is a stretch. I would probably say within the next 7 to 10 years, the era of these big pandemics will be over. What we will have are local outbreaks, maybe in a regional scale, maybe at max one country will suffer it. But the idea that you will have a pandemic which will scare the whole world and affect the whole world is a thing of the past. Now, why do I say that? Point number one, Moore's law has kicked in biology, right? So using computing technology for analysis, for synthesis, means that we are able to detect and diagnose health issues much faster than ever before. So if we have to sequence the viral genome, we can sequence a viral genome in a matter of hours now. And in the next 5 to 10 years, it's probably going to be in a matter of minutes and seconds. So the ability to analyze viral genomes to characterize how pathogens work is going to exponentially grow. At the same time, how we generate treatments, vaccines, for example, a lot of vaccine design, drug design is done on supercomputers today. So your ability to characterize molecules and understand how these molecules operate in human and biological systems is also going to grow manifold and follow Moore's law kind of a dynamic. Which means that in the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to be able to characterize, you know, viruses are extremely simple things. We'll be able to characterize viral genomes fairly quickly and come up with antidotes in the forms of vaccines or treatments also fairly quickly. Now, I'm not, speaking out of my hat, because the current vaccine that has been, which has actually gone on to clinical trials in the United States early this month, actually was created in a span of 7 days, 7 to 10 days. It took them about 42 days from the reporting of the first outbreak to a candidate vaccine being prepared in the United States. Right now, this vaccine might or might not work. But what we know is for the first time in human history, we've been able to create a vaccine while there is an ongoing epidemic, right, for this virus. Similarly, the viral genome was sequenced in a matter of days and hours. So we already have some facts to talk about, right? We already have a situation where there's an unprecedented ability to analyze viruses and create vaccines and antidotes. Now, second is because of the scale of this pandemic, everybody in biology is going to be interested in trying to do virology and epidemiology because it's suddenly become interesting, right? Just like how counterterrorism became interesting after 9/11, you have virology and epidemiology and anti-pandemics becoming a very, very interesting field for intelligent people around the world, from computer scientists to mathematicians to biologists, right? And third, big foundations like the Gates Foundation, big governments are going to invest a lot of money in pandemic research and management, right? So putting all three things together, synthetic biology, Moore's law in technology, talent flows, and government and big philanthropic investments, I think I can go out on a limb and say, look, this was the last big pandemic. We probably will have a cat and mouse. No, we will certainly have a cat and mouse game with pathogens. That's for sure. But we will be able to contain these outbreaks into much smaller forms than we've been able to do in the past and even have been able to do currently. That's the argument.
So, Nitin, I'm going to jump in. This is Narayan. And I'm going to play a somewhat unfamiliar role of being a skeptic in this observation. Yeah. Of course, I'm skeptical on the nuance rather than on the basic proposition. So I like your basic proposition that human ingenuity and human talent has generally shown the ability to rise and combat mankind's problems. What I call the anti-Malthusian spirit and scientific temperament, particularly since the age of the Enlightenment, has shown itself capable of dealing with, of course it has created, the science itself has created enormous horrors like the nuclear bomb itself, but mankind has found ways of even deterring that horror. So I do think that human ingenuity will in some ways rise to the occasion. But my counter argument to that would be, and it almost goes back to biblical times, if not earlier, that the four horsemen of the apocalypse in the New Testament, one of them was called pestilence, and not for no reason. Viruses have been around, you know, a gazillion years more than humankind. And how they exist and how they change, mutate is a scientific word, is not fully still understood. And our ingenuity will perhaps get us to combat the last one almost perfectly and the current one a lot better than any previous time we've done it. But that we will be able to stay completely ahead of it is not clear to me at this moment. Let me just illustrate that. So, for instance, everything you've said is already true, but if I just changed one thing, and if I said the rate of transmission, what scientists called R0, for this virus was not 3.5 or whatever we measure it today to be, but 10. And let me just change one other factor, that instead of human-to-human transmission by aerosol substance, it can actually be transmitted through the air. With just these two things, you could have had a pandemic of, when it's already of gargantuan proportions, it could have had an absolutely negative effect. And what the mutation is that might cause those two things and how you get to those mutations is completely unknown, at least in advance of the mutation happening. And so while I agree with you that ingenuity will create the ability to understand these things better, sequence the genome quickly. By the way, the genome was sequenced this time in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks compared to several months in the case of SARS. But we do stupid things like keep wet markets in China still open. So there's a human protocol problem. But in addition, even science, even at the new speed limit, may or may not be able to catch up with new and mutating small beings. Nitin.
Yeah, see, I think that's a fair note of caution. But I think the reason for optimism is this. It's not like humanity has no experience in tackling viruses. I mean, the smallpox virus, for example, is extinct. What do they call it? We've eradicated smallpox. I think polio is under control. AIDS is under control. So if you remember in the 80s, AIDS was supposed to be killing us, right? AIDS was supposed to kill all of us before we were going to be 25 years of age. But here we are, right? So there has been some amount of confidence that we've gained from being able to counter, you know, viruses in the second half of the last century. But yeah, moving forward, here's interesting, right? See, the mutation thing is true. it's not that humanity has to be totally and massively in victory over the virus. All you need to do is to be one step ahead, if not keep in step, just be one step ahead. Now, one of the most interesting areas, and I've been spending some time reading up on this and researching this, I don't really have accurate information at this time, but artificial intelligence is being brought in the game, in the antivirus game. Because just as how you can predict the next change in a computer virus and install antivirus protocols onto your computer systems, you can also do that for viruses, right? So now this moves beyond just looking at the last virus and creating a vaccine for the last virus, but to be able to predict changes in the viral genome in the short term, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and then say, look, this is probably going to be the kind of new virus we're going to get, and let's protect against it. So I think the same process which works for Moore's law and this new process which comes in terms of artificial intelligence is going to be some kind of a game changer in this story. But let's put that technological predictionism aside and just look at something like counterterrorism as an analogy, right? Now, before 9/11, there was terrorism. I mean, we were suffering terrorism in India for a long time before 9/11. And we were talking to various countries and, there was our sort of case against terrorism fell on deaf ears because nobody else seemed to suffer from it in the same kind of acuteness as we did. But the moment 9/11 happened and the United States was struck and the West was struck, there was a greater sense that this terrorism thing is an international problem and everybody from Nauru to the United States have to do something to counter terrorism, right? And that kind of counterterrorism focus meant that, by the time it was 2005 and 6, Al-Qaeda had almost run its course. Bin Laden was caught a few years later. But, the kind of terrorism that we witnessed in the 90s and the early part of the 2000s was more or less finished by 2005 and 6. Now, does this mean terrorism has ended forever? I don't think so. But are the world's governments in a better position to tackle terrorism? I think yes, right? Protocols are this. Just give you a little number before you go on, Narayan. Before 9/11, the US government's expenditure on counterterrorism was about $16 billion a year, right? And I have no idea what they were doing with $16 billion a year. But the combined US government expenditure on counterterrorism jumped up to about $200 billion by 2010, $235 billion by 2010. It peaked at around 225. But if you look at the cumulative expenditure on counterterrorism from 2002 to 2017, 15-year period, it was about $2 trillion, right? And that's just the United States. So that's the kind of money that is, follows prioritization of a problem in the rich world. So now that the pandemic has hit the United States, China, and Europe, I think the amount of money which is going to go into this, the kind of attention which governments are going to pay in public health and surveillance and so on is going to be massive. So I expect, therefore, that we will be, probably half a step ahead of that virus.
So Nitin, interesting, and I like your sort of cross-reference to terrorism. So let's sort of go back and forth between the two, and I'll start with terrorism as well. So if 9/11 was a major marker in terrorism for the response that you speak about, and part of that came not only from the magnificent amount of money being thrown at the problem, but also because there was a coalition against terror that was particularly valid among the NATO countries and so on. So there was this very concerted, both human and technological and financial effort thrown against terrorism. If for a moment, and we can debate whether this is true or not, if we call 9/11 a terrorism pandemic, there were, and you may call these epidemics, there were obviously India's own 26/11 after that. And this is where maybe the metaphor breaks down. The entire rise and rise again before its eventual fall of ISIL that then became ISIS in the Levant and in larger areas than the Levant is debatable whether terrorism peaked 9/11 or not. Now, it's true that the US and its allies combated terrorism massively after 9/11. And this time we have G2, both America and China, dramatically sort of at the center of this crisis. And therefore, you're going to get the top two countries in the world sort of going after this. But it doesn't seem to me that as a consequence, and even as terrorism itself demonstrates, that we can say whether we have shortened our distance from being five steps behind in the Spanish influenza of 1918 to half a step behind or half a step ahead. And given, of course, terrorism as intent, which is a very, very difficult problem to crack under any model, but separate intent and add mutation for pandemics, and of course you could add intent to mutations as well, which creates yet another possibility. But for a moment, let's keep intent out of mutations and just say mutations. It's not entirely clear to me whether we have closed the distance from five steps behind to half a step behind or half a step ahead. And of course, only time will tell. But I am not 100% sure that we can conclude that we will remain. Now, of course, a few pandemics, or let's just say potential pandemics, will have been thwarted. And debatably, maybe Ebola already was one such. But it's not clear to me that beyond thwarting a few terrorism incidents, or several terrorism incidents as we have done after 9/11, that we can altogether say we've completely conquered them and they've been shut down.
Yeah, you see, I think the analogy in terrorism and this thing works at one level. I think we shouldn't, I mean, I brought in the analogy, so I should raise my hands and say, look, we shouldn't stretch this analogy too much. But here's what it means, right? Once there is a high level political awareness that, look, this is a problem and we've got to tackle it. And B, here's a lot of money which we are bringing in to tackle it. And C, here are incentives we are going to create for the government structure in order to tackle it effectively. You're going to have the makings of a policy backed by money, backed by incentives, which can tackle the problem. Now, how would that work, let's say, in the case of antiviruses, right? Let's say counter-pandemic kind of a policy. See, I think the first one would be to intervene at the point where these new viruses are emerging in the wild, right? For example, wet markets of China. Now, the story here really is not that there's something unique to China and wet markets. It's about the fact that you're keeping a lot of animals in close proximity to each other and to humans, right? So that creates the ability for a virus to generate and mutate quickly and affect a particular species and then mutate again and jump species and attack humans and so forth, right? So your starting point there would be to ensure that you don't keep animals in close proximity. Now, there's actually mathematics to this. You know, how many chickens can you keep in close proximity to reduce the risk of a viral mutation, etc.? And then people have sort of worked this kind of number out, right? And what's the minimum distance and the minimum number of animals you can keep? Maximum number of animals you can keep at what distance in order to have a particular kind of risk. And now these risks have been modeled. Now the question is, what kind of policy incentives are we going to have both nationally and internationally to ensure that these measures are actually adopted? This is similar to knowing, for example, that a terrorist could bring explosive on board, and what are the kind of protocols you're going to have to prevent explosives from being sold in the open market, fertilizers being sold in the open market, or explosives being sneaked into airports and so forth, right? So the kind of problem is similar. At one point, you were dealing with explosive ingredients and getting them into the airport, and now you're dealing with farm animals and how close are you allowed to keep them, and what are the kind of agricultural health practices that you need to follow in order to, not to have an outbreak. Now, none of this is rocket science. It's been known. It's just not been practiced. But now the emphasis will be on practice. I mean, for example, we could look at Tyson's, which sells frozen chicken, saying that we're only going to buy from farms which meet XYZ kind of requirements, right? And then immediately you'll see a lot of poultry farms around the world changing their operating model their geometry in order to satisfy Tyson's. It's this kind of a Walmart effect. Right? If Walmart procures from you and insists on a particular set of standards, then a lot of third-party manufacturers will change their standards in order to satisfy Walmart. So I think that is one process which is almost inevitably going to happen in the next couple of years, right? Governments will know once bitten, twice shy, let's tackle this at source. Now, the second part of this is, I think, incentives of local governments and national governments themselves. I think Xi Jinping will now see that this COVID coronavirus is this biggest blotch on his so far unblemished career, right? And this is, he'll be seen as a president who sort of presided over the fact that there was China created this global pandemic. And he's going to fight the propaganda war to defeat that. Let's leave that aside. But every potential leader in China now knows that, look, this is going to be a problem. It's going to blow up on my face. I've got to make sure that it doesn't happen at a local level or at a regional level. So I think the incentive structure for leadership will change. You know, for example, even in India, one of our colleagues whose parents live in a small village in Maharashtra, very much isolated from towns and other villages, apparently had the district health officer turning up and asking people whether they are feeling well, they've had flu symptoms, and whether they had travel history or they've had visitors from places which have travel history. This is like literally boondocks of boondocks. So I think the incentive structures will change now, and I'm optimistic that they will change. And one thing about governments is once you tune them to a new frequency, they stay at that frequency. You know, there are vested interests which are built up in government departments, getting new budgets and new equipments and new toys and new kind of resources to solve the same problem. So I think that the fact that we dislike some things about government will now actually kick in to help us.
I mean, particularly given the general values that we all work with at Takshashila, I completely agree with the idea of both the human talent response as well as the human talent response to incentives, and the nature of this incident creating both individually and severally a completely new scheme of incentives that works for everyone, right? But the history of humankind, and I'll give you one example here. So I was just saying, as a case in point, I just want to talk about the U.S. The U.S. obviously was not affected by SARS in 2003 in any meaningful way. However, based on the 9/11 set of events, there was a whole anthrax scare, if you remember. And then there was this whole institutional, both money and talent, focused on disease surveillance and bioterrorism and so on. And one of the acts of Trump was to dismantle that entire thing. So in a period of 15 years, or actually in a period of few years after Obama, a lot of that was completely dismantled. So yes, the incentive to tackle things like this is there, but there can also be the counter incentive, which is once it recedes a little bit, then other priorities take over. And when those take over, then you've got it precisely wrong. And usually that happens for things that happen very, very infrequently. So the insurance cost on a cumulative basis begins to get high. And when the so-called 100-year flood hasn't happened in 80 years, you say, okay, it is not happening now. And then, of course, it happens right when you dismantle the whole structure that you've intended for it. So there is this counter incentive as well. So I am of the view that we will get a lot better. We will be in a different place with respect to surveillance, with respect to testing, with respect to protocols, with respect to citizenry and their behavior to these kind of things and so on. But it is not entirely clear to me that the history of humankind, which if you were to write it in simple words, would read war and pestilence, is ready to be changed, despite the general positive nature of the post-war existence that we've all lived.
That's true. I think, as I think Einstein is the guy who said, in the context of nuclear war, you know, this is in 1949 or something, he was in a conference and they were talking about nuclear strategy. And then somebody said to Einstein, why is it that you're not able to persuade these guys? And Einstein said, politics is a much more difficult problem to crack than physics, right? So I think there's no doubt about the fact that international politics, domestic politics, human affairs will certainly screw up regularly, and it's about how regular the screw ups are. But I think one good thing is the kind of tools that are available to humanity have improved dramatically over the last 150 years. Right? And that's another exponential thing. And the kind of tools that you have, therefore, allow you to contain and mitigate the damage of your own folly much faster and at a much lower cost. So that's where I would sort of come in. So because I said, look, for example, we're not going to win a war against pathogens, right? You can't look at it in terms of prevailing over a pathogen and defeating a pathogen, but being able to contain the effects of the pathogen's virulence, right? So instead of having a pandemic, which is global scale, imagine you just have it as a national outbreak or a continental outbreak. So that would be an improvement over a pandemic. And instead of having a national outbreak, if you just have a state level or a regional, subnational outbreak, that would be an improvement over a national epidemic and so on. So the ability to contain outbreaks into small geographical areas, even in the spite of higher levels of virulence and, let's say, mortality, I think that's what is improvement, right? And to the extent that our tools also take shape at a pace which allows us to do this, even if we wake up a couple of weeks late and say, oh my God, we screwed up, now what do we do? If we have the kind of tools that allow us to contain the problem much faster, I think we'll be able to limit it. But then again, I agree with you, Narayan. There are no guarantees in this because you just can't predict how a new germ or a new life form will turn out and do something to you.
So Nitin, let me interrupt with a question. And the question is actually going beyond pathogens and the science related to testing and discovery and combat and getting to the medical system, right? So as we have discovered very, very unfortunately in Italy and perhaps equally unfortunately in Seattle, and I think we don't even know where the evolving situations will take us, the peak load capacity of certain medical systems have been completely overwhelmed in this instance, right? So do you think we will learn to use an old electrical engineering term, load balance a lot better in our medical systems than we have through this crisis? I mean, we have a pathetic set of ratios that played out in Italy. And God forbid if this thing makes its way in a serious way of community transmission in India, we will have unfortunately similar kind of requirement to availability ratios. Do you think load balancing will improve?
Yeah, see, that's the most interesting policy challenge right now, right? And going into the future. Every country is going to be overwhelmed when there is a pandemic, right? And in our case, for example, even before COVID came along, the healthcare system was fighting a lot of new fevers which didn't have a cause. There's tuberculosis, there's typhoid, there's malaria. So our healthcare system is already, you know, even before the pandemic came along, we were already under capacity, right? Massively under capacity, given the kind of health risks that we have and the disease burdens that we carry, right? Now, I think what will be interesting as a policy challenge is how do you create surge capacity in healthcare? Now, of course, you can't create the kind of surge capacity which you need every pandemic out there. But can you go from current capacity to 10x, current capacity to 100x in a short period of time, right?
So it may be apropos that we had a little technical glitch quite at the same time where we'll be talking about how amazing our technological response is going to be. That said, I think Nitin and I were just chatting about the ability to handle surge requirements in any healthcare system, India as an example, but in any healthcare system. And I think in certain aspects of it, we are going to make tremendous progress. So, for instance, we were caught with our pants down on ventilators. And frankly, the technology in the world already exists to have relatively cheap home deliverable ventilators. Of course, it requires a little medical supervision, but it is entirely possible to create home level ventilator systems that can in some senses manage a lot of this rather than have to rely on only ICU bed. The advantage of home level ventilator systems is also that then using the reserve army or the army itself, you can create isolation points that are then de facto very fast response system, intensive care isolation units, if you will, where you're creating 10, 20, 30, 40,000 in a matter of days, rather than having to rely on an existing tertiary health system, which often has only hundreds of beds and is therefore can be overwhelmed if the cases start mounting into the thousands and then beyond. So I think some part of this we will learn, but a lot of work will need to be done on the screening and the testing in such a manner that the people who actually end up in these spots are the ones that need it. And those that don't are actually treated in a different way. I think towards the tail end of the first phase of this crisis in China and South Korea, they had sort of figured that out. And I think that's another lesson that the world can learn that unfortunately Italy had not learned by the time the crisis sort of overwhelmed them.
See, I think there'll be two dimensions to how we're going to respond after this, right? One is how can we get public healthcare systems to have surge capacity to be able to 10x or 100x grow basic hospital capacity in a short period of time. And that's a policy and a logistical challenge for governments. And I think it is within the realm of the possible to create field hospitals, quarantine facilities, basic healthcare systems, both in terms of physical capacity and infrastructure, as well as human capacity and infrastructure, care capacity, for example, the amount of doctors that you need. So one of the important recommendations which I would make to the government of India is that scale up the number of doctors that and nurses that you have 10x in the short period of time, right? So that in the next 5 years, if you can create 10x more doctors and 10x more nurses, you have much more human capacity to sort of address this problem. And the second is a challenge which involves pharmaceutical economics. The vaccine for flu today, the commonly available vaccine for flu today, which you have to take once every year, costs about 1,500 rupees in retail. Right? That's beyond the means of most people in India. So we've got to be able to bring down the vaccine costs to very, very small numbers, such that large numbers of people can be vaccinated, not just in India, around the world, right? So vaccinating and immunizing people against known flus limits the kind of risks that are out there and which will spread. So vaccinating people, mass vaccinization against flu is probably one of the global public health responses which need to be thought about. Basically, you've got to get the economics right. It can't be 1,500. It has to be in the range of a 10 rupee per person kind of a price point. I think there are technological challenges here in terms of synthesizing these vaccines. But if enough money is thrown at the problem, I think we'll be able to reduce price points to, you know, something 10, 20 rupees in the next 5 years. And that, those are the two prongs which I think we'll have to be looking at. How do you raise hospital capacity and care capacity in the short term? And then how do you figure out how you can immunize large numbers of people?
So I just want to jump in here and make this an unfair fight, but you know, two against one. So it's interesting that we're now talking about things like building capacity and so on. I'm just going to make the argument that we are victims of our own success. And so that the fact that we have eradicated so much poverty, that human beings have escaped the Malthusian trap, also means that we suffer from climate change and environmental degradation, which will probably open us up to new pathogens. Globalization will make viruses spread faster. And it's not just viruses, because we are in an arms race against bacteria and we're getting super bugs already. And we'll have to develop entire new classes of bacteria, basically, to stay ahead of the curve. Aren't those some countervailing factors?
Aditya, you know, international cooperation on common threats have three dimensions, right? Why do countries cooperate on certain threats and why not on the others? I think there are three important dimensions to this. One, is there an agent that is causing it? Is there a visible, as Narayan said, it's about intent. Is there an agent with an intent that is causing this? So, for example, Al-Qaeda blowing up buildings is different from climate change warming the seas, right? In the latter, there is no intent. The second is the immediacy of the threat. Is this going to happen tomorrow morning or is it going to happen over the next 10, 20 years? And the third is the relative cost and relative benefit, right? The relative impact. So if some countries feel they'll be more or less okay, while other countries feel we are going to be in trouble, and still other countries feel this is going to be good for us, getting cooperation is going to be hard. Now, in the case of the coronavirus epidemic, the current one, you saw a lot of cooperation happening because although there was no intent, there was immediacy, and there was no sense that you will be relatively unscathed. Whether you're India, whether you're China, whether you're Italy or United States, the likelihood that it will spread in your country is as high. So there's no relative advantage to be had, which is why I think we saw an increasing degree of cooperation. If there was intent and there was an agent which was coherent, I suppose we would have had a lot more intent because you could say it's us versus them and there's this clear enemy that we can focus on. In this case, you don't have an anthropomorphic enemy, but you still have the other two dimensions kicking in, which is why there was action. So climate change, unfortunately, follows the, you know, none of the above with this, right? You know that there is no common agent with intent. Relatively, some people will be better off, some people will not. And it's not something which is going to happen tomorrow morning. It's going to take its own sweet time. You know, sweet time in the sense 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And that's why you don't find people acting together. A pandemic will be different.
So Nitin, I'm going to swap hats and I'm going to now speak about the positive side and hopefully that'll take us that'll take us to conclusion here. So I think, you know, in the spirit of this discussion, human ingenuity and innovation combined with the scare and consequently the incentive and money that will be thrown at this problem will make a material difference to how we tackle these things in the future. And so this problem in quite this way is unlikely to happen in the future. So in conclusion, I will give you that.
On that note, I think we've got something to meet, Narayan. The two ends do meet.
We do. Until next time.
Okay. Thanks so much, Nitin and Narayan. This has been a stimulating discussion, both sobering and optimistic. I mean, in happening in fairly grim times. Thank you both for joining us.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.